So I can either choose to, I want the credit for giving it to them, or I'm going to allow other people to get the credit for doing it. So the things get done, but it's not about me anymore. I can now do anything, and you as a listener can do anything as long as you don't put yourself in the center. It's that simple. So yeah. It's all about the choice. Do you want just to get credit for the things you are able to do? And you can keep it doing that. But if you want to do bigger, grander things, you can, as long as you don't insist that you get the credit for every single thing.
Hello and welcome to our podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we talk to business people, journalists, ambassadors, artists, sports heroes, sages, gurus, leaders, and luminaries from all over the world to dispense wisdom for life and for business, and to provide you with shortcuts to excellence. My name is Siebe van der Zee, and I'm your host. I'm originally from the Netherlands, living happily in beautiful Arizona in the United States, and I'm also known as the Dutchman in the desert. I hope you will enjoy this program. This podcast is sponsored by PDF, the Professional Development Forum. You can find more about PDF at professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Our guest today is Ori Eisen. And Ori has spent the last two decades fighting online crime. He is the founder and CEO of a company called Trusona, based in Arizona in the United States. He is a founding member of the Security Canyon, Arizona's cybersecurity coalition, and he holds over 24 cybersecurity patents. Prior to Trusona, Ori founded a company called 41st Parameter. The company is focused on online fraud prevention for financial institutions and e-commerce entities. 41st Parameter was acquired by Experian in 2013. Prior to that, Ori also served as worldwide fraud director at American Express and as director of fraud prevention at VeriSign Network Solutions. But there is more. Ori volunteers with an organization named Thorn, an international anti-human trafficking organization fighting against sexual child abuse. Ori also founded Ball at All, a charity that donates free soccer balls to children around the world. As they say, kids playing, it will help them grow healthier, happier, and at the same time, keep them out of trouble. I like that a lot. Welcome, Ori. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's really interesting to have our conversation today and listening to your lessons. I'm also curious, of course, when we talk about cybersecurity, things have evolved quite rapidly. And I want to say terms like ransomware are now part of our daily vocabulary. And perhaps as a quick question, which is not easy to answer, are we looking at solutions for cybersecurity, or is it simply reacting to new events and new situations and we have to respond, or can we prevent things from happening in the future?
It's a good question. I'd say half of it are crimes that have happened for centuries. They're just now happening online. So those will not change anytime soon. And half of them are crimes that are only available now because of how our new life in the 21st century looks like. So if before I could go from town to town and sell a tonic that would cure everything, I would have to physically go present myself. Today, I can just send an email to millions of people and do the same thing just digitally. So I don't want to say that the problem we see will go anytime soon. I know the good guys, like companies like Trusona that I worked at, are trying very hard every day to plug the holes we have in the dike. However, some of the issues we see are just as a result of human gullibility and people clicking on things because they want to see, you know, the next celebrity picture of something, not realizing they're falling prey to some cyber criminal.
Yeah, fair point. If you think about it, before we get into your 10 lessons, if you think about lessons that you have learned in life and in business, is there one that you would say that is the greatest or perhaps the first major lesson that you have learned?
Yeah, it is on my list. And I'd say it's never as bad as you think it is the greatest lesson I've learned. That when you get hit with bad news, literally things in your brain cause the fight versus flight emotion to come up, and it looks like a life or death situation. But 24 hours later, 48 hours later, it's always not as bad as you thought it is. So learning how not to react immediately, or not let the downs be so low or the highs be so high has helped me be healthier, both mentally and physically. I wish I knew it or exercised it when I was younger, but I guess some things take 50 years to learn.
Was there a specific moment that taught you that lesson that you said, okay, I can deal with this? Was there a specific example?
Yes. About 15 years ago, I found myself on a hospital bed because I was overworking myself. I didn't take proper vacations. I was very stressed. It was my third startup with very large VCs. And I thought that business comes ahead of family and business comes, I guess, ahead of your own well-being. And in that hospital bed, I just realized, you know, it's the reverse. And I realized that if I would just look at things differently, think about them differently, the stress and the emotion and everything that comes with it will just not affect me. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy to have learned that lesson.
Even though you were in the hospitals, I'm sure dealing with a serious issue.
Yeah, the body basically will tell you, you know what, you can keep doing what you want. I'm not doing it anymore. And it manifests itself in different forms. But I knew that I was not really sick. I was causing my body to be stressed and sick. So if you just change the stress, the body will just heal itself. And guess what? That's exactly what happened.
Important lesson to learn and to remember that. Let's take a look at your 10 lessons that you sent me. And there are several that I'm real curious about. But let's start with lesson number one. You can do anything if you don't care who gets the credit.
Absolutely right. The first lesson is true. You can do anything you want as long as you don't care who gets the credit. If I want to give soccer balls to kids all over the world, I can't go and do it myself. Physically, I can't. So I can either choose to, I want the credit for giving it to them, or I'm going to allow other people to get the credit for doing it. So the things get done, but it's not about me anymore. I've learned this lesson from Colin Powell. And when I heard the words for the first time, I honestly didn't really understand what they mean. But every year since then, I've taken this lesson to heart. I can now do anything. And you as a listener can do anything as long as you don't put yourself in the center. It's that simple.
Now, in some situations, Ori, it could be that I do something and I feel that I deserve credit for what I did. How do you compare those two?
Yeah. If the motivation is to get credit, you can do some things, but they will be limited. But the lesson is you can do anything if you don't care who gets the credit. So yeah. It's all about the choice. Do you want just to get credit for the things you are able to do? And you can keep it doing that. But if you want to do bigger, grander things, you can, as long as you don't insist that you get the credit for every single thing.
It's a fair point. And it's, again, it may be perhaps somewhat generational that you have to go through life with certain experience to see the bigger picture and say, hey, as long as the result is what it is, personally, I don't need the credit.
As long as it gets done, that's what's important.
Lesson number two, the hardest thing to do is to do it.
Correct. How many of us said, I want to lose weight. I want to go to the gym. I want to treat my kids better. I want to have time for myself. How many of us thought about these things and said these things? It's so much difficult to do it. So if you ever wanted to write a book, write a podcast, write a blog, go volunteer, the hardest thing is to one day put it on your calendar and do it. Like start. After you start, it's easy. But just keep thinking about it. Will never get you anywhere. So the hardest thing to do is to do.
Is that something that you have done your whole life, or was that also something that you learned over time?
I've learned over time that when I look at my notebook of all the things I ever wanted to do and my calendar of what did I actually spend my time doing, that dissonance told me that if it's not set for a date and an hour, it will be in my wish list all my life. So I'm winking at you and at the audience to say, you want to go volunteer, put it on your calendar, just like the meeting with your boss and the meeting with your customer, put it at Saturday at 11 a.m. that says, go do that thing, like block the time. Then you'll see that you'll start doing your dreams and living your dreams as opposed to just dreaming them.
Great points. I think it's fair to say, Ori, that you and I probably know quite a few people that truly keep track of the list that they write out. And I joke about it. I make lists of lists that I have. And it continuously is updated. It's not to say, well, I wrote a list for this whole year, so that should be fine in January. I update it. Is that something you do as well?
I do. And when I'm approached by people who want me to invest in their new startups or ventures, the first thing I try to ascertain is, are they a true entrepreneur or are they a wantrepreneur? And yeah, there's a big difference.
Good point. Good point. Lesson number three, taking proper vacations is a must. You already alluded to that a little bit, but was that part of the lesson that you described that you said, hey, you really need to give yourself a break?
To you personally, coming from Europe, I don't need to say that August is a sacred month and people just go with their families to the beach and everybody in business realizes we are going to take some time off.
I would say no wonder that people like to work for you.
They work with me. Thank God, not for me. But here in America and in Western culture, we don't know how to take proper vacations. So if you're listening to the podcast, maybe at the end, you'll see a link to my blog, oriison.com. There's startup advice, and I have a whole article about taking proper vacations and how to do it. Because the main fear people have is like, oh my God, something bad is going to happen at work, and I will be on vacation, and people will think that I'm not a team player. But there are ways to do it where you give your second in command the ability to make decisions. And if there's a crisis, they can text you or call you, but not check your email every hour and pretend you're on vacation.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I think it's important. I think that in certain countries, and you and I are both in the United States, it may be perceived a little bit differently. Yes, you need vacation, but a long weekend should be good enough.
A long weekend is not a vacation. A long weekend is the good respite from 5 days of working 10 hours a day. A vacation in my book is 2 weeks straight without being in meetings. And I know many people who are hearing it say like, what? Go read my blog post and ask yourself, have I ever really taken a vacation? Because until I realized it, I would steal 2 days here, 4 days there, and think that not being at the office means being on vacation. That is the biggest myth. You're lying to yourself. If you are somewhere else, but you're still staring at your phone and you're going through the anxiety of work, you are not giving yourself time off. And your family and your children and your spouse, they want to be with you, not with your phone. Read it. And that is my advice.
Very valid.
For vacation.
I need that advice, my friend. I appreciate that. That's a good point. Lesson number four, you can coach by just asking questions. You never need to raise your voice. I'm sure you have some examples. I'm sure you have coached lots of people. Have you been coached as well?
I think life has been my best coach. And I'll leave it at that. I was a young man who's very ambitious. And not everybody around you has to be ambitious or is ambitious. So it creates a dichotomy between, you know, managing and teams and so forth. But what I've learned is most people are good people. They want to do good work. They might not have the same drive as entrepreneurs, but you can resolve anything just by asking questions and understanding the situation, as opposed to, again, raising your voice as an example of how anger takes a hold of you and then you're not cool, calm, and collected anymore. Again, I write about that, Sibe, that you can untangle the most difficult situation just by asking questions and leading the other side. It could be a person, a child, or a team to understand where the frustration may lie or the issues may lie. Yeah. It does not have to end up with anger.
It's a very valid point. I say that also because I do a lot of coaching. I've done it for many, many years. And when I coach individuals, of course, I want to say, but that's not for everyone to think that way. Of course, I don't come in and say, Ori, I think you should do this. I think you should do that. You are so correct. And it is part of the professional approach as well. I collect information from you, perhaps from other people that know you. Perhaps there are other tools we can use, an assessment tool. We collect the information and I enjoy it to a certain extent, perhaps, when the person that I'm coaching disagrees with those outcomes. And again, it's not for me to say you're wrong and let me tell you why. It is more listening until that individual that he or she notices that I'm on the wrong track. I have to make adjustments. That is the only way, in my experience, to be successful in coaching. And that's clearly part of listening, not just telling people.
Exactly. We have two ears and one mouth. The ratio is very clear.
Yeah, absolutely. Lesson number five, thinking time is underrated and there's not enough time spent on ideation, if I pronounce that correctly, before action. The question for me is, what do you have to do to create thinking time?
Block it on your calendar. If you realize, and when you realize, thinking time is just as important as doing time, and my hint to you would be it's more important than doing time, and I'll give you an example in a minute, then you will block time for yourself to think, to sit, to stare, to doodle. You will get amazing ideas by doing it, as opposed to just being busy typing the next email. There's a famous quote that says, if I had time, I would have written you a shorter email or a shorter letter. Because if you just write your stream of conscience, it's not edited, it's not refined. You don't get to reflect by thinking. We get to see things that you can't see if you're in the heat of battle.
It's still difficult, perhaps, for people to schedule the time that way for thinking time.
Let me ask why. You see, I'm practicing on you my coaching style by asking questions. Why is it difficult?
Because I'm busy. I got so many things to do. And perhaps when I'm stuck in traffic, maybe that allows me some time to think about things. But there is so much that we all have to deal with.
I'll rebuttal with this. If you think that education is expensive, try ignorance.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're an executive, if you're an employee, and you spend no time thinking about what you're doing, let me assure you, you are not optimizing your time, your money, your brain, your efforts. But if you take 1 hour of thinking to 9 hours of doing, those 9 hours will be so well thought out and maybe easier, as opposed to just working for 10 hours and not thinking about what you're doing.
Now, you're also then alluding to perhaps a certain level of discipline. Right? Because you have to a certain extent, train your brain to allow thinking time.
Correct. Just like we should train our lives to take proper vacation time. Downtime is not really downtime. It's not like you're sitting there and you're a bum and you're not doing anything. Downtime allows you to not be distracted from the next call or text or email. And God help us, in this 21st century, there's a lot of distraction around us. When you block time to really think, to write, to ponder, you might get a aha moment. You might get an epiphany that I assure you would never happen if you just kept working.
Good point. Thank you. To our audience, we are talking right now with Ori Eisen, a successful global cybersecurity expert and entrepreneur, sharing his 10 lessons that he has learned. Ori, lesson number six. Begin with the end in mind. I look forward to your explanation, and I may push back a little bit.
I'll tell you a very short story that my father told me. They tried to build a very large kite when they were kids, and they planned to have two ropes and a bar so a kid could swing in the air while the rest of the kids are holding the kite. Sounds like a great idea, right?
Yeah.
So they worked 2 months on building the largest kite they could ever build. The kite never took off. So I'll give you one chance to guess why, but then I'll tell you. So what do you think? They couldn't get this kite to take off.
Maybe it was not constructed correctly.
So I usually do this with a team of like 10 or 20 people. So that's a very common answer I get. There was not enough wind, all kinds of things. But no, the kite was properly crafted and it was strong. And the day they tried to fly it, the wind was very, very good. And they had a volunteer kid to go up on the, everything was perfect, except for one little thing. The shack where they built it, the door was too small for the kite to get out.
Well, this is a strange comment from my side to this example, but a famous painting by Rembrandt, The Night Watch in Amsterdam, only recently they realized that the famous painting was not the correct size. because in order to fit it where they hang it in the museum in Amsterdam, they had to cut off the left side and the right side. They have been able to reconstruct that just in the last few weeks, but that's an example that kind of fits with the kite example. In this case, we're talking about Night Watch by Rembrandt, but it comes down to that same point. I do want to ask, though, because begin with the end in mind, that is the lesson, but how do you combine that with thinking out of the box? You're in the process, you're trying to develop things, and there is a brand new idea coming from, you know, the left side, the right side. Whoa, how do you include that? Because are you saying, you know, begin with the end in mind? We already know what we want to achieve.
Yeah, that's a great question. So let's separate working time and ideation time or thinking time. When you are ideating, you should come up with the wildest, craziest ideas without thinking first about the end. Just think about what if we could do this and what we could do that. But once you say, wow, I really like this idea, let's go monetize it, let's go build it, let's go make it happen, let's build the kite. Now you need to think it through all the way to the end, because otherwise you'll have issues that you haven't thought, I'm going to get to the end, but there's no button to push. I'm going to get to the end and forgot to price it. I'm going to get to the end and there's no key to the car, right? That's when you have to do very thorough work to make the implementation. But the thinking and ideating time should be free-spirited. There's no limits to, you know, bad ideas, good idea. And again, I'm going to go back to you need to set some thinking time. And then when you go execute, begin with the end in mind.
It perhaps links also to your next lesson, lesson number 7, sharpen the saw, spend time to train your team on problem solve.
Right. Again, it's one of Stephen Covey's habits from the book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Mm-hmm. In that book, he describes 2 teams that are trying to cut trees with met saws, you know, those big tree cutters. And the question is, how would a team win in a competition? So imagine team one says, well, that's very easy. Let's just cut tree all day long. I mean, well, what is there to think about? And team two decide that 55 minutes out of the hour, they will cut trees. And the last 5 minutes of every hour, they will sit down with their files and sharpen their saws. Now, which one do you think will cut more trees at the end of the day?
Sharp saw.
Yeah. And which one will be less fatigued when they go home?
Yeah, the team.
And if you had a gauge of happiness on your hand, which one would be happier? Like had joy de vivre, right? Of course, the team that worked less hard, because if you sharpen your saw, it's working smarter, not harder, which again ties to the other lessons I'm alluding to. Sitting and thinking, sitting and problem solving even somebody else's problem may at the end of the day give you the linchpin to solving your own problems.
I'm thinking about this, and is there perhaps in your approach something about the difference between macro management and micro management? How would you describe your management style in that respect?
I always want to give the team a brief, the mission. Here is what we need to do, and I can give you an example, and not tell them how to do it, even though I'm urging to tell them how I want to do it. But remember rule number 1, if you want to do anything, don't get the credit. It's not about me and my idea. If I will always be giving them the idea, they will just be drones. They will just be their worker bees. They will never think for themselves. If you want to have a workforce and a team that is thinking creatively, even when you're not there, you have to let them do it. And yes, they won't do it perfect every time. I'm not perfect every time. You're not perfect every time. But if you don't get practice, you surely will not get better. So macro managing, I kind of consider 19th century way of managing people, like in the army. I think with today's generation, again, of millennials who are in the workforce, it is much better to just tell them what we are trying to do. Now come with solutions of how to do it. And you can rule out 9 out of 10 solutions they can come up with. That's fine. But it's very different than we need to do this. And here's how I'm telling you to go do it. Now you're in a relationship of master and servants or boss and, you know, people who are deputized as opposed to thinking people who can come up with the next great idea.
Is that, you think, part of modern day thinking to say, hey, I tell you what I see as a manager as the desired outcome. Now you, team, make sure we get there. I can think of quite a few people, I'm sure you can too, that say, look, we got to reach this goal. So I'm going to watch you, you know, every day, and I'm going to tell you every day how to do it, et cetera, et cetera. Is that a style that you think is time-wise more up to where we are today, 2021, or is it simply advanced management experience that is not generational in that sense?
Yeah, I actually think it's both. And to be crisp, I want to say this. Say that we have the goal to do XYZ. It doesn't really matter what. And you as the CEO already have an idea of how to do it. So let's call it plan A.
Yeah.
My advice is don't tell your team what plan A is. Task them to come up with their own plans. Now they can come up with no plan. They can come up with the same plan A and you say, great, that's what I was thinking. Let's do it. And they can come up with plan B and C and D. Now that doesn't mean we're doing B, C and D if you don't like it as the CEO. If you compare plan A to B, C and D and they're not better, then you can still tell them, you know what? I've heard you. I listened. Let's do plan A. But you know what? Plan B or D might be better than A. So
yes.
Unless you give people the chance to think for themselves, you are probably hurting the business as the CEO by not being open to ideas that are not your own. Again, it's not about you. It's not about who gets the credit. It's about what needs to get done.
I agree myself, but I can see that that is a bit of a challenge in organizations sometimes where they want to maintain either ownership or simply, hey, I'm in charge, so everything has to go through me. But if you look at the bigger picture, I fully agree. And I can think of many examples. And I think it also fits with my Dutch heritage, right? Where we're all equal and you can learn from people that have perhaps a few years experience. That is important to be open. But I recognize that in some, and perhaps in some industries and in some cultures, that is something that is perceived maybe differently.
Yeah. And I'll just say one more thing. As a leader, I cannot be absolved from making the right decision. So I can either make them for the team or I can solicit more ideas than my own just to see if they're better. I will still pick what I want to do. So I don't want you to be confused about that. But if I will only expose the team to my idea, I never even ask him, do you have a better idea? I may be the very blocker of the company.
Yeah, no, it's clear. I appreciate it. Lesson number 8, if there is a doubt, there is no doubt. I think I know what you're talking about, but please explain.
Say that you and I are taking a road trip and there's a doubt if I filled the gas tank or not. Then there's no doubt we should not begin the trip until we check it.
Good example.
If you have a doubt that something will go wrong, there's no doubt that we're not going to just continue. We're going to go check something. That's what the lesson is.
How does that compare to expect the unexpected?
Yes, the unexpected should always be expected, right? I know it's a oxymoron, but the point is if you know that something may not be okay, so that's the known knowns, you should not continue with ignoring it, right? So think about flying in an airplane. If there's a doubt it's not mechanically correct, there's no doubt it's not going to take off, right?
Correct.
If you take that lesson and then interpolate it to a customer project, to a road trip, to did I feed my kids, right? All those little things. If you have annoying doubt at you that something is wrong, there is no doubt that we are going to check it and make sure we're not proceeding full force before further, you know, inspection.
Now, perhaps I'm taking it out of context, but someone who is looking for a new job and he or she goes through the process, interviews, more interviews. It looks good. It feels good. But you don't know, right? I see your smile. At the last moment, it can go the other way.
Yes.
How do you mentally prepare for something that you really don't know?
Yeah.
The outcome of, yeah.
It might be controversial to say, but I hope you will allow me to give you my life lessons, even if it's wrong. Every time in the last 50 years, when I've analyzed what my gut told me to do and what I actually did, more times than not, my gut was right, not my head, not my brain, not my mind, not my logic. My gut knew very, very good. Don't take this job. Don't deal with this person. Don't go to this shop. Don't buy the. Your gut is older than your brain. It senses things in a way that I know it's very difficult to explain scientifically, but if you have a gut feeling about something, trust it. Even Jack Welch, the best CEO in our, you know, known universe, His book is called Straight from the Gut, and would highly suggest you listen to that advice.
There are several things from Jack Welch that I apply in my business, so I'll look for that particular element. But let's say a little challenge here, Ori. You go with your gut, but you also refer to earlier thinking time. So on the one hand, you want to think it through, you want to use your brain, and then there is your gut feeling and say, oh, I'm sure tomorrow the weather will be like this because it's supposed to be like that. How do you combine the two?
If I knew, I would be a billionaire. Management is all about a black art of looking at numbers, at data, at opinions. But having seen all that, still say my gut tells me this is wrong. Because if we would only look at data as a way to make decisions, there would not be any decisions to be
made. Fair.
It'll be perfect. When you look at the World War II and D-Day, it was all down to gut feeling, not about statistics and numbers and anything else, because the commander and the manager have to kind of feel the situation. And the greatest ones are being paid for their gut feelings, for take all of your life experience and put it into a decision that no other person could have seen because they don't have the collection of the knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, you're touching on something here when you use those examples where indeed how people behave while they're under stress and how people, not everybody, but people make decisions because they feel it is the best thing to do under the circumstances, even if they assume a very high risk, whether it is related to their job or even sometimes their family safety, if you talk about some of these examples, right? So it's a very valid point to go with your gut. And like you said, you have been able to compare it over time and your gut typically wins.
Typically wins, that's correct.
Now, lesson number 9, and it's going to touch on something that I'll bring up unless you do it already. But the lesson is family first, always.
In Trusona and in other companies worked in, we have house rules. You can look them up. They're also on my blog. These are rules. They're not open to debate. And one of them is family first. What does that mean? Say, Sibe, you were working with me on a team and you had a death in the family, but you still showed up to work and you pretend to be working and you pretend to be with us solving the mission that we're all working on. But we all know that your mind, your heart, your body, your spirit, your entire being is elsewhere. You're mourning, you're grieving. Are you really helping the mission? No, you're not. If anything, you're not focused. We feel for you. You are a distraction at this point. If your family needs you, you have a sick parent, sick child, somebody in the hospital, somebody who just needs time, go be with them with your entire being. Go support them because they are the meaning of your life, not work. And when you're done with that, come back and be with us to go, you know, solve the mission we're on. But if you don't put your family first, you're a pretender. You're here physically, but you're not really here. And you don't really understand your priorities, which will end stressing you out and putting you in hospital. And I don't want to be responsible for that. Note the lessons about taking proper vacations, right? You see, it's all tied into stress management.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't take your family first, always, man, you don't know who you're working for, because the most important people you work for are not in the office. They're back home.
I, of course, agree. It makes so much sense. And I think that sometimes, I mean, the concept of family, right, can be broader than perhaps immediate close family. And I want to use this topic to ask you a little bit about your charitable work, because family first always, but it looks like you have extended that family to children around the world, very serious issues. Maybe share with the audience a little bit your thoughts on your charitable work and the big family that you take care of.
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity. I didn't expect to do it, but I appreciate it. In 2013, I started an organization called Bowl to All. And it was a result of a simple experiment and an experience I had, which I'll share with you, that changed my life. I thought that kids all over the world may not have the luxury of playing with a real soccer ball. And again, I never experienced it because I came from, you know, a well-to-do family and I live in the United States. Then I had one employee, his name is Nick, who was born in Kenya. When I kind of bounced the idea off him, he said, you know, I grew up in Kenya in a school that never had a real soccer ball. So we made it up out of nylons and bags and dirt. I'm like, are you kidding me? Why don't we do this? Let me go here to Scottsdale to the Walmart on a north side. I bought 5 soccer balls with my children. And I sent it with him to take back home. And he happened to have taken it to the very school he came from. The pictures he sent back, Sibe, of the school with 200 kids stopping the school like they have never felt and seen a real soccer ball. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
The principal just shut down the school, took all the kids out of classes. They inflated the soccer balls. And the joy you see in these pictures is so immense and so touching that I decided from that moment on, and I've been doing it religiously every Saturday, so tomorrow I will do the same thing, is to give soccer balls all over the world to kids who cannot afford one. And I've been doing it now for over 7 years. To be honest with you, it's the thing that brings me the most joy, because when you see the pictures you can see on Instagram or Facebook or boltowall.org, man, you understand what poverty is and what the fact that these kids have nothing. So for $10, if you can give them a soccer ball, it's like I will give a kid,
I don't know,
PlayStation, something like that, right? It will be the same level of joy. So I can't find a better use of my time when we talk about time management to do that. And I have been doing it every weekend for the last 7 years.
You're a father of, I believe, 2 children?
Correct.
So obviously you are involved with your family, but this additional activity, all to all, but other things that you're involved with, do you see that indeed as a, for yourself, like a, like an extended family? Is that concept?
Absolutely. I will share this again, might be the last life lesson that you would ask me about. So I'll share it with you. When we are children, we think only about ourselves. I want ice cream. I want a bicycle. I want, right? We only think about I. In the second phase of our life, you think about the other. I want my mom to be happy. I want my friend to be happy. I want her to have an experience. I am now in the third stage where it's not about I, and it's not even about me giving flowers to my mom, which will, you know, it's a fun thing for me to experience, but it's to give my mom money to buy flowers from somebody she wants to give the flowers to, for her to have the moment of giving. So my family is really the ambassadors I work with, because I fund them every week and chart them with one thing: go find kids who don't have a soccer ball. I don't want to know who they are. I don't care who they are. I don't want to know their name. Just go do good. I'll just help you have the moment. And repeatedly they tell me, the moment you have the experience you have given me to give a soccer ball to a kid who doesn't have it is priceless. And you see, it's not about me. I wasn't there. I don't care to get the credit. That is my family. Those people who are joining this organization to do good. And by extension, of course, every kid that we ever given a soccer ball to, which is now over 20,000 children, is part of my extended family, even though I don't know their names every time.
I understand. But you know what? I can see it on your face. It's very genuine. And there is a link in a way to the purpose of our podcast, because we want to talk to wise people like yourself who have gone through these different mountains of success and self-evaluation to share that information with up-and-coming professionals at any age, as we always say, around the world. It's a perfect fit. Lesson number 10, we're almost there, right? It's never as bad as you think it is. I know. Why not?
I know we started with it, and it's a good place to end the 10, and then you can ask me any additional question. But as human beings, we are still carrying our DNA from thousands of years ago, that if you would see a saber-toothed tiger, you would start running or start to... It's a natural reaction. I would say that today, when you get an email with bad news, a text message with bad news, you don't think about it, but it's just like the saber-toothed tiger. Your brain does not know any better. It's still reacting with fight or flight. And that puts adrenaline in your body and stress. So even though we think we don't live in the jungle anymore, or we don't have animals who can, we are reacting in the same way to news. And God, you know, you read the news like I do. There's a lot of good news and bad news. So when you get especially bad news, if you don't stop yourself from reacting to it, you will just be kind of being spun down into a very dark place. Again, you will literally hurt yourself by being miserable. It's never as bad as you think it is. A day later, 2 days later, a week later. And you can do this test with me right now. I'm sure, Sibe, when you were a child, I don't know, an ice cream dropped from your hand. And you cried. And you thought it's the end of the world, right? And now you don't even remember that it happened. So that is the proof. It's never as bad as you think it is as time goes by.
Allow me to challenge you a little bit, because I like what you're saying. And I use a similar wisdom as far as, you know, don't create mental baggage. You have to get over things. But there are situations, and I'm sure you are aware, that are really serious, life-changing, sometimes life-ending. And it's not to say, well, tomorrow you'll be fine. It will have a lasting impact. And I'm just curious, because I know you understand that. When you say it's never as bad as you think it is, my simple response would be, well, why not? In some cases, it's really bad. You still have to deal with it, with the loss of a friend, a relative, family member, or you missed out on that job and you got to start all over. You got to deal with that. You cannot say, oh, well, I'm fine.
Yes. So note that I'm not saying bad things doesn't happen to good people, because it sure does. And on the day you learn a loved one has died, let me tell you, it's devastating. Happened to me.
Yeah.
But right this moment, as I'm speaking to you, I am sure not as devastated as the moment I got the news. And that's the lesson.
Okay.
If at the moment you get the news, you think this will be like this forever and I'll never be happy again and I'll never have joy, it could lead to very bad places. It's never as bad as you think it is, because even at the moment that you think the world is ending, give it 24 hours, give it 48 hours, and you'll just see that the edge will be taken off it. It would still be bad. So if it's an injury or death, it will still hurt and it will still be there. But in business, especially, like you hear a customer is leaving you, and if you get that email, let me tell you, it is not fun. But if you'll not realize that in 2 days, a new customer may join instead, or, oh my God, this was a mistake and we didn't mean it. I read it in India on a wall once that I'll share with the audience. Worry is a misuse of your imagination. People who worry all the time only think about the bad outcomes. So if you only want to delve into the bad, you will just put yourself into very dark places, sometimes very difficult to get out of, by the way. All I'm saying is, as bad as the news is, it's going to hurt, it's going to be bad, but just remember, give it a day, give it 2 days, it will not be as bad as you currently think it is. That is the lesson.
Yeah, makes sense. I like it. I want to ask you, we've done the 10 lessons, but I do want to ask you another question. And that is, are there any lessons that you have unlearned in life or in your career? Anything that you decided, I got to change this?
Yes. So unfortunately, there's many, which is another 10 just about what I had to unlearn. No one is born perfect. And again, life is a very, I won't say cruel teacher, but a very cold teacher, because only after the experience, you learn the lesson, as opposed to in school, you learn the lesson to get the experience. I'll give you, if you don't mind, two.
Please.
One is, some things are not worth conquering the Bastille. And the lesson here is, what we think is important in any given moment of time may not be so important. We might think it's important because we're hurt, because of ego, because a competitor did something, so I think I need to do something else. Like, we're very reactionary as human beings and very emotional. Not everything you should make a fight out of. There are some things that just letting it go, as hard as it may seem, is actually a better course of action than fighting it out.
I'm learning, still learning that. And you're absolutely right. Sometimes it's just not worth the fight. Even if you are convinced you are correct and the other person is wrong.
And even if you are assured that you will win, it is not worth it.
Good point.
Okay. The other thing I'll share with the business people in the audience is that no company is an island. I had to unlearn that. When you start your own company, you want to be there for your customers and do all those things. But no company, think about the largest companies in the world. Think about McDonald's. They cannot do what they do on their own. They still need to have farmers to grow potatoes, and they need to have all bakers to make their buns, right? It's not that McDonald's is baking their own buns. So you have to unlearn the fact that you can't do it all on your own. And of course, picking the right partners is the opposite of this, that you also have to invest time in thinking about. But no company is an island. And if you don't mind, I'll give a third thing that I had to unlearn.
Please.
Again, especially where I came from and the culture I came from, not everything is a life and death decision. And it's a very difficult thing to unlearn. If you are in a very stressful environment and you constantly worry, even if somebody cuts you off on the road, right? You might think that it's a life and death situation, right? Because of how we react. Not everything is life and death. And if you came from a family situation or a culture or a country or an environment that is stressful, knowing how to unwind is probably the hardest thing to do, but the most healthy thing to do, because then you will get to a higher plane of thinking, of operating. And I hope even when I speak to you with my own voice, I'm trying to exude my own balance as I speak, because we are very reactive as humans, right? If I'll start to be very animated and very stressful, just by me doing it, you're going to do it. And you'll, because we're tribal, and that's how we kind of got here. So learning how to balance and not to make anything about life and death, if it doesn't have to be, is a great thing to unlearn.
I like it. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank you for sharing your wisdoms with our audience. It's been delightful to talk. And well, I would have so many more questions, and perhaps we can think about that, do a future podcast or other type of conversation. But I really want to thank you, Ori, for participating. And in closing, I want to mention that you have been listening to the international podcast, 10 Lessons. It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, sponsored by PDF, the Professional Development Forum. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, and parties. And the best of all, it's all for free. For more information, please visit professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Our guest today has been a global cybersecurity expert, Ori Eisen, from Scottsdale, Arizona, sharing his 10 lessons that took him 50 years to learn. And to our audience, don't forget to leave us a review or a comment. You can also email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That is podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and hit the subscribe button so you don't miss an episode. And remember, this is a podcast that makes the world wiser and wiser, podcast by podcast, lesson by lesson. Thank you and stay safe.